The story we heard from the book of Numbers is a story from the desert. From the desert wanderings of the people of Israel. And not only is it a story from the desert, but it's a story that contains elements that are very, very old. We know that the book of Numbers was written down in the Iron Age, but that book of Numbers was a compiling of stories and lore that had been shared for hundreds and perhaps even thousands of years. That there are some elements in the book of Numbers and in the story that we heard today that stretch back to the Bronze Age undoubtedly, and probably even some elements as old as the Stone Age. It's an ancient, ancient story. And we must recognize that this ancient story has hung around because it's got some qualities that resonate with our unconscious selves, that it can be interpreted as one might interpret a dream. Certainly, it is not a story to take literally, because the Hebrew Bible describes many loving and compassionate aspects of God that are inconsistent with the idea of a God sending poisonous snakes to punish people. And certainly the God that Jesus taught us about was not a God who would send poisonous snakes to punish people. But there is lots to learn from this story. More to learn, in fact, if we don't take it literally. The setup of the story is this. The people have been wandering in the wilderness, wandering in the desert for a long time now. They are closer to the end of their desert journey than the beginning. It has been a long, long time. And they have just experienced the death of Aaron, their high priest. So that was a significant loss to the community. And that takes its own kind of energy, and grief takes work. And the text says that they spent 30 days grieving the death of Aaron. And as they began to go on their journey, a king from a southern Canaanite kingdom decided to attack them, and God gave them the victory over their enemy, but it still took a lot of energy and a lot of work. And then they continued on their journey, and the king of Edom would not let them travel through his territory, so they had to retrace their steps to go around the kingdom of Edom. So it felt like they were going backwards. It felt like they were going back the way they came, that felt like they weren't making any forward advances. And the Hebrew text says that they grumbled against God and Moses because their spirits, I love this phrase, became short with the road. Their spirits became short with the road. They were tired of being on that journey. And they complained about the journey, and they complained about the food. They've been getting manna for a long time now. And we must remember that manna is created from two Hebrew words, ma and na. And ma and na mean what's it? Right? What's it? They're tired of eating the what's it. That stuff they couldn't even give a name to. They couldn't define it. It was what's it. And they were tired of eating the what's it. It says that they said in the Hebrew, it says they complained to Moses and God, "We detest this light bread." This light bread. It wasn't feeling substantial anymore. It wasn't filling them up in some way, perhaps emotionally more than physically. It wasn't filling them up. They were tired of the journey and they were hungry for something other than what's it. And they lashed out, they grumbled against God and Moses. And as I read that and thought about that reality, it occurred to me that, boy, that is so true. We lash out at people, and we lash out often at the wrong people when we are subject to our own sense of being hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. The old anagram, HALT. When you're too hungry, too angry, too lonely, or too tired, it's time to stop. Time to stop and sit down and nourish yourself. Replenish yourself. And when we aren't able or we don't do that, we lash out at people. We lash out sometimes at the wrong people. Usually we lash out at the people we're closest to. The former assistant bishop in Chicago, Bishop Wiedrich, used to joke about how his kids would go away to their friend's house to do an overnight or some kind of event like that. And when their friend's parents returned them, they would say how wonderful their children are and how polite and gracious and everything. And he would think, look at his kids and think, who are you and what have you done with my children? Okay. It's safer to act out at home than away. It's safer to lash out at the people you're closest to than the real problem. We lash out when we're too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, when we need to halt and replenish our batteries. So that's what happens. That's what where they are. That's how they are at that moment. And they lash out like that. And this is a place where we encounter a very ancient piece of the text, right? It's actually a piece of sympathetic magic. Sympathetic magic is an idea that stretches as far back as the Stone Age, where like produces like. So in sympathetic magic, for example, in Israel, before the rainy season, it's windy, and the palm trees and the palm branches blow in the wind. And so it came to be a practice when you were praying for a healthy harvest. A healthy harvest requires what? It requires rain. And people believed under the ideas of sympathetic magic, maybe if we wave palm leaves like it does before the rainy season, it will rain. And so the harvest festivals in Israel have the waving of palm branches as part of the celebration. And it's an old practice that stretches all the way back to the Stone Age and to the idea of sympathetic magic. And so what happens here is that when we are lashing out, when we are hungry, angry, lonely, and tired, and not able to be still and replenish ourselves and replenish our batteries and our spirit, it often feels like we're sick. Not being able to replenish our drained selves can leave us spiritually sick or emotionally sick or physically sick or all of them. At once. It can feel like a burning snake bite. And in the story, what happens is the people speak maliciously. They grumble against God and Moses. And so, under the aegis of associative thinking or sympathetic magic, what is like grumbling? What is like speaking maliciously? Well, the first story about speaking maliciously is the serpent in the garden. And so the idea that snakes come to punish them is a hearkening back to that story. You read some ancient rabbis on this story, and they say that, well, They were speaking maliciously like the snake spoke maliciously in the garden. It's a kind of sympathetic magic. But the idea is that poison happens when we grumble. Poison, relational poison, happens when we lash out. More often than not, that poison happens and we lash out because we've become drained. And we're too hungry, angry, lonely, tired, hurt, upset. And we don't know how to stop and replenish. And so this happens in the story. It's described for us by these poisonous serpents, these fiery snakes whose bite probably feels like fire. And the people, they go to Moses, whom they've been grumbling to, and ask him to pray for them. And the text says that Moses prays for them right away. They ask him, he does it. And so buried in the text there is a question about forgiveness or an admonishment to forgive. Moses could have said, what? Just a minute ago you were complaining at me and now you want me to pray for you? I'd have been tempted to say that, but he didn't. And isn't it true that when we're too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, one of the things that goes away quickly is our ability to be forgiving? It happens. And so Moses prays, and God tells him to make a snake on a pole that people can look at. And that's a problem for biblical scholars, right? Because it wasn't that long ago on Mount Sinai when God says you won't have any graven images, and then he tells Moses to make a graven image. What's up with that? Very confusing. What's more, after the whole snake incident, after this whole thing is over, they take that copper snake, is actually what the Hebrew says. They take the copper snake and put it in the Ark of the Covenant and carry it around with them. And later, centuries later, I think it's King Hezekiah or one of the prophets takes the snake from the ark because they're afraid that it is an idol, that people have been praying to it, and they smash it. So it's very confusing to biblical scholars why God would say something like that. But again, I think the question is one of sympathetic magic. It's that old Stone Age thinking. The cure for the snake bites is to look at a snake. And so Moses makes the snake, and he makes it out of copper because in Hebrew the consonants for the word serpent are the same as the consonants for the word copper. So again, like and like. A play on words, if you will. So Moses makes the snake and puts it on a pole, and the Hebrew for that word for pole is the kind of pole that you put a banner on, so it's a really tall pole. And he puts this really tall pole and he puts this copper snake on it. And the text says that whenever someone is bitten, they would look at the snake and be healed. But those of us who've been reading Rabbi Kushner's book, Eyes Remade for Wonder, remember that he said that all the little inconsistencies and discrepancies in the text can be fodder for meaning. And in the Hebrew, there is a discrepancy. God says, if anyone is bitten, let them look at the snake and live. And we have to remember that this was long, long before there were antibiotics. And any kind of bite was exceedingly dangerous. A dog bite could kill you. A mule bite could kill you. A snake bite could definitely kill you. And the ancient sages notice that God simply says, if they're bitten, and doesn't say by the snakes. And the text later says anyone who was bitten looks at the snake and is healed. And then it says, and if they were bitten by the poisonous, fiery serpents, they would gaze at the snake, the copper snake, and be healed. And so there are a couple of meanings buried in that little discrepancy that we pay attention to the way Rabbi Kushner has taught us. The first one is the idea that the problem at hand was poisonous snake bites, and God gives them a solution that works for all bites. That's important. In fact, that's crucial. The teaching there is that God's solutions are always bigger than the problem. That God's solutions always reflect the abundance of God and God's continual gift-giving and grace. The problem is snake bites. Here's a solution for all bites. That's the reason John's gospel picks up this image in the gospel that we heard today. Jesus says, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, when I am lifted up, he means on the cross. And certainly a common way to interpret the human problem is to describe it in terms of sin and the need that we have for the forgiveness of sin. That's a common theme. It's Lent. We expect that. But the solution in Christ that God gives is so much bigger than just forgiveness. It's almost as if God is saying, you think the problem is sin, fine, I'll forgive you. But the solution is, I'm going to join your life to mine. And when we look up and gaze at Jesus on the cross, we see God dying because that's what we do. We die. And that crucial, actually almost defining aspect of our life is taken up by God. So that when we die, we don't die alone. And when we die, it's not the end of the story because our story continues in God who died. God's solutions are always bigger than the problem presented. You think the problem is sin and you need forgiveness? Fine, you're forgiven, and I'm joining your life to mine. You think the problem is snake bites? Fine, here's a cure for all bites. God's solutions are always bigger than the problem. That's one thing buried in this story. One very important and powerful thing for us to remember. The other one is that the difference between looking and gazing is crucial because when we gaze, we take time. The prayerful gaze takes time. We have to stop. To gaze. We have to be still to gaze. Nobody gazes on the run. If you gaze on the run, you're going to run into a wall or a tree or something else. Nobody gazes on the run. You have to stop. And that's what our anagram HALT is trying to tell us, that when we're too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, we have to stop. And we have to gaze. And there's an important healing quality to the prayerful gaze. When is the last time you gazed at a beloved? When is the last time you gazed at a cross? Or you went out and you gazed at the lake, or you gazed at a sunrise or a sunset, or something particularly beautiful. When is the last time you gazed? One of the glories that we have with Carol playing cello and Carrie on the organ and a wonderful choir is we get to gaze with our ears when we hear beautiful music. And we sit and we rest in that beautiful sound. Because you can gaze with your ears too. Or we gaze with our eyes when we stare at our kids reciting a verse or singing a song they learned in church school. And we gaze. And the prayerful gaze is healing. And that's in this story too. Buddhist teachers say you shouldn't close your eyes when you pray. And that's very different than in the West, where we were all taught to bow our head and close our eyes, right? Very interesting that they say that. But they say you can't see the world in all its spiritual fullness if you keep closing your eyes when you pray. And the teaching that Buddhist teachers give is if your life is too distracted and flighty and disconnected, look a little downward while you pray, but keep your eyes open. And if your life is too burdened by things and details and problems and earthy stuff, lift your eyes up a little when you pray. And isn't that part of what's happening in this story? Is that God tells Moses to make this snake. Moses makes a copper snake and he puts it on a banner pole so that it's up real high. And when people are bitten, they might be frantic, but they have to stop and look up. They have to gaze heavenward and gaze at the copper serpent and find healing. The prayerful gaze is one of the things that puts us in touch with God's healing and God's solution, which is always bigger than the problem at hand. And is the right solution for being too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. And so this ancient, curious text reminds us of the importance of prayerful gazing and invites us to practice that very, very old spiritual discipline. What have you gazed at recently? What might you gaze at this week?